Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Behavioral and mental health problems are very common, and they contribute to physical problems and patient complaints. Perhaps not as widely appreciated, but social issues such as income inequality, educational level, housing, access to food, literacy, lots of behavioral or environmental factors are also strongly related to the health of many Americans. Primary care settings are often the gateway for many behavioral, mental health, and social issues. To address this, primary care providers are beginning to integrate behavioral and/or mental health care services directly into their offices. On this edition of Line One, your health connection, we will be discussing behavioral and mental health care integration in primary care with Jessica Adams. Jessica received her master's in social work at UAA. She worked for about 4 years as a mental health clinician at North Star Hospital before joining the Alaska Center of Pediatrics as a behavioral health specialist about 2 years ago. Jessica, welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
And I need to give some full disclosure as we begin this program. So while you're listening to it, keep in mind that Jessica works at Alaska Center for Pediatrics, and I work at Alaska Center for Pediatrics. So you might want to kind of keep that in mind as you're listening. There's possibly some biases that you may feel are creeping in, but we'll be as honest as we can about the topic, and I don't think that should be a big issue. If you have questions or comments during the next hour, let me tell you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. If you call us, you can call directly at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And you need to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line one, all one word at alaskapublic.org. So let's start with a little bit about your background. So I happen to know a lot about it, but the listeners don't. So how'd you get into mental health or behavioral health, and what have you been doing to bring us up to date?
You kind of already said it all, but I got my master's degree from UAA. Before I got my master's degree, I worked in disability services and also did some in-home services with at-risk families. But after I got my master's degree, I worked at North Star for about 4 years, mostly with adolescent girls doing individual group and family therapy. I got the opportunity to start behavioral health at Alaska Center for Pediatrics, and I was really excited about that. Mostly for the aspect of being able to focus a little bit more on prevention, and that was really intriguing to me. So,
the other thing that we ought to kind of ferret out at the beginning is, what do we mean by behavioral and mental health specialists? Who are and what are the kinds of degrees that people may run into when we talk about those professionals?
There's social workers, which is my background. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and then there's also psychologists, licensed professional counselors, and I think that's pretty much the majority of the providers you'll find.
Psychologists and psychiatrists, how do they differ?
Well, for one, psychiatrists are able to prescribe medication, where psychologists don't typically do that.
Yeah, I still get see people confused about that. Psychiatrist is basically a physician, had to get an MD degree. Because of that, they're able to write prescriptions. Psychologists have a PhD in psychology and are not licensed to write prescriptions of medications.
Right.
When we talk about primary care, let me clarify that. Primary care physicians are generally general practitioners, family practitioners, internists. Those are individuals who take care of adults, and pediatricians who take care of children, usually somewhere from birth up to 18 or 20, like myself. And then often obstetric gynecologists are included because they may exclusively take care of women with primary care issues as well. But that's what we're talking about when we say primary care. The other thing that I would like to get off the table at the beginning is there's a lot of issues that we're going to talk about as we begin to bring you into the Alaska Center for Pediatrics of Primary Care as a behavioral health specialist. And one of the things that took me a little bit of time to really begin to understand was how our administrator, I think, and maybe along with you, began to make the distinguishment between behavioral health and mental health. And I think that finally made sense to me. And what do we mean by the differences there?
Well, behavioral health is something that is actually a little bit hard to define. It kind of depends on who you're talking to. But from my perspective, behavioral health is kind of a big umbrella, and it's kind of focusing on any behavior that contributes to overall well-being. So that can be your physical well-being, your mental well-being, or even your spiritual well-being. And that includes substance abuse, so not just mental health and not just physical health, but also substance abuse. And the difference between that and mental health is a little bit vague, but in our pediatric practice, kind of what we focus on is behavioral health in terms of looking at all types of behaviors, so not just behaviors that are associated with mental health, but typical behaviors too that affect functioning.
Our administrator came to me one day and said, you know, but to her, and because we wanted to do the right thing for the right people, she kind of said behavioral health is more short-term kinds of things versus
right.
long-term, which often is more mental health. Does that make sense to you too?
Definitely. And one of the other ways I kind of think about it is, again, with behavioral health, that can be for children, that could be, you know, something that's not associated with a mental health diagnosis, but something that's affecting their well-being. And that can be a short-term intervention. But if you're talking about somebody who maybe an adult or even a child with something like bipolar disorder, you know, a short-term intervention isn't going to be as effective. They might need more kind of wraparound support and things like that.
So for the purposes of our offices, that's part of the way that we separate. It doesn't always work that well, but
right.
way because there's often people with significant mental health needs that have trouble getting in, and we're trying to help them in the meantime. But that's one of the things that we've struggled with the integration idea. We're going to talk about some other problems, but that's one that really sticks out in my mind.
Right.
So I have often felt for years and years and years that behavioral mental health issues are a very, very significant portion of the job I do every day as a pediatrician. And, of course, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I often quote a book, a paraphrase of a book, maybe a better one, called Caring for Patients that I must have read 15 years ago, written by a physician named Alan Barber. And Alan was the head of outpatient medicine, the outpatient clinic, adult clinic, at Stanford University Medical Center for 40 years. And after about 30 years, he had collated and collected all the reasons that people ended up in their system. And then he wrote a book about it and probably published some stuff. But this was basically just for medical consumers and the general public. And in the short answer, although he gave a very good write-up on this and described each of these issues a little bit better, he said about a third of the people that ended up in the outpatient clinic had a purely medical problem. They broke their leg. They had a myocardial infarction. They had an ulcer. About a 30% had no specific medical issue whatsoever. They were anxious. They were depressed, and so forth, bipolar. And then another third had a medical problem, but the real reason they were there was not necessarily their medical problem. It was behavioral, psychosocial issues related to their medical problem. They could not afford the medication. They didn't understand how to take the medication. Their dementia made it difficult for them to care for themselves, something like that. And so if that's true, and it really knocked me on the head because I said, even in pediatrics, I think that is true. It really said two out of every three visits on average to a primary care physician is really the crux of the problem is not primarily their medical problem. Does that makes sense to you as a mental health specialist?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was actually coming from a mental health background. I was sort of really surprised when I first started at Alaska Center for Pediatrics how many parents came in with behavioral concerns. I just hadn't really considered that before, but it's very frequent. And I think I did just recently read something where it said that depression is like the third on list of the top three things that people go to their primary care physician for. Depression is number three.
Yeah, maybe. I think I've seen symptoms or ideas. It's the most common chronic disease in the world.
Right.
So you were surprised at the number of people that came in. So it had to take getting into a primary care system to see that what you'd seen in the past was not just a biased population of people that had a lot of mental and behavioral health issues.
I mean, I worked in long-term treatment, so mm-hmm. everybody that I saw was there for mental health concerns.
Yeah, very biased population.
Definitely, yeah. And so, everybody at that point had been involved in the mental health care system, and they kind of knew where to get services. So coming to, a pediatric office and seeing how often parents came in, with just their specific concerns were anxiety, depression, sleeping problems, things like that, I was really surprised.
Let me take just a second. Jessica, I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Jessica Adams. She's a licensed clinical social worker who works at Alaska Center for Pediatrics as a behavioral health specialist. What we're talking about today is how and why the importance of mental health or behavioral health is being integrated into primary care practices. And to give listeners some flavor of the purpose of that and where the future may lie and the importance of these particular issues we're talking about. If you have questions or comments, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us over the next 50 minutes or so. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email is line1@alaskapublic.org, and we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. What was it specifically then, since you were surprised? I'm a little surprised that you were surprised. So let's focus on that a little bit. What in particular do you remember noticing? I mean, you don't see every patient that comes into our office. We grab you when we need to make it convenient for patients or to get some background and some education, maybe on a parent's mental health problem, which will help us understand what's going on with the child. But what do you recall specifically?
I guess I recall, thinking to myself, and maybe, maybe I just hadn't thought much about it before, but I remember thinking to myself, if I had a child with anxiety or I was concerned about, their sleep or maybe depression, something like that, my first thought, maybe because I'm a mental health provider, would be to go to a mental health provider.
Yep.
I realized quickly that not everybody knows how to access those services, and it's not necessarily even on their radar to think about that. So.
Yeah, and I think a lot of families don't necessarily recognize anxiety for what it is. I mean, one of the problems with, to me, the anxious patient is they think they have significant problems that are out of proportion to, at least from the medical perspective, the reality of what's going on.
Right.
And that's the nature of anxiety, is we misinterpret, overinterpret things. We're the proverbial the glasses half full of problems instead of half empty of no problems.
Right. And another thing, that you see often, too, is like school avoidance. So sometimes parents will come in just concerned that their child is, got such bad stomach pain that they can't go to school. Right. And then we can kind of a lot of times see that, that that's an issue of anxiety or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So anxiety has been an issue. How about depression? I'm always a little bit anxious myself that we miss depression in our office despite the fact that it's on our radar. What do you think? Are we missing depression? Can depression be hidden? And parents certainly often are not thinking about it, although I think we are becoming a little bit more enlightened in our country. I think we do think about it a little bit more, but I still think people are surprised when we bring up the topic.
Yeah, I think depression is easy to miss. I don't know, with children, it's easy to miss, especially young children. Sometimes depression is kind of presents itself as other behavioral outbursts or other behavioral challenges when the underlying might be depression. Mm-hmm. So that's easy to miss.
So typically, children may not get quiet and subdued. They may get, they may act out. They may be harder to deal with. They
Right.
may be harder to parent. And the real issue is, I'm struggling with something out here.
Right. And there's other things that are like that too. I would even say, you know, things like ADHD, sometimes hyperactivity and impulsivity look like ADHD, but might also be related to other things going on in that child's life mm-hmm. too. So
now that's a point that is at least worth bringing up. I think from a medical perspective, as a pediatrician, I think my understanding is I see a fairly common amount of attention deficit disorder, but my training is, my understanding is, in preschool age children in particular, you've got to be very careful about that diagnosis because so many other factors may contribute to what appears to be attention problems.
Absolutely, I agree.
Why would that be? What is it that is affecting kids differently in the first several years of life that may make them appear to have attention problems or behavior problems?
Traumatic exposure, you know, just a lot of chaos and disorganization. So if a young child experiences a lot of different moves or a lot of different caregivers or any kind of disruption in their normal life, you know, over a period of time, that can look like symptoms of ADHD, just kind of disrupted, dysregulated behavior.
So children are learning a little bit about how they should behave, and their nervous system is learning how to respond pretty early in life based on what they see in their environment. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
So tell us some more about what we know about that.
The environment a child grows up in has, you know, a lot to do with the way that they regulate their own body. For example, you know, I right now teach a parenting class, and one of the things that we talk about is, you know, structure and routine for young kids is really important for them, you know, to know what to expect. We were talking about this in our class the other day, that if you thought about yourself, you know, sitting down in front of the TV in the evening with something to drink, and then, you know, unexpectedly somebody came up, you know, kind of took you by the arm and said, oh, we're doing this now. Or if somebody mm-hmm. did that all day long mm-hmm. and you never really knew what to expect, it's pretty hard to, mm-hmm. you know, be able to calm your body if you never really know, mm-hmm. you know, what to expect and when somebody's going to throw you a loop. So.
Yeah, one of the advantages of having you is we do our little weekly educational sessions in the office. We pick up some hints, and one of them that I was not aware of that I've begun to use more commonly is especially in the preschoolers and the very early childhood is let them set the direction of play. And as parents, we often wanted to make sure our kid grows up well, so we were going to make sure what they needed to do or direct their play, but you told us, no, actually, it's probably better to let them direct their play.
Yeah. It's called child-directed play. It's used in a lot of different you know, therapeutic interventions in parenting classes, but the idea is to let them direct the play and that, you know, when kids or anybody is engaged in what they're doing, they're more likely to learn that way than if we're forced to do something that's not interesting to us. And then also child-directed play does a lot for building attachment and relationship, which is the foundation really for all parent-child relationships.
So if the relationship between a parent and their child is built up and is strong and respectful of each other, then it improves the likelihood of a beneficial, appropriately social outcome. I guess I'm trying to maybe not saying the right words because this is not my language.
you know, I mean, that's correct. And I would say kind of on the more practical side that if you have a strong relationship with your child and that you spend lots of time engaged in child-directed play, that children are more likely to listen to you when you are going to redirect them to something they may or may not want to do.
Uh-huh.
They're more likely to be compliant.
All right. Let me once again let listeners know you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Jessica Adams, a licensed clinical social worker at Alaska Center for Pediatrics. And we're talking about the integration of mental health and behavioral health into primary care because the primary care physician, provider is dealing with behavioral health issues, mental health issues on a regular basis. And the other reason I think of it is, at least in pediatrics, the kind of patient that I'm seeing day to day has changed dramatically in my 30 years as a physician. We used to see and worry a lot about very serious physical and particularly infectious disease problems, which have not disappeared but are dramatically improved with the onset of better understanding of them, better environmental control, immunizations, antibiotics. So those are not as big an issue as how do we help parents raise and support them as they raise kids that are going to be productive in society. So from my point of view, what I do every day is significantly different than it was 20 or 30 years ago for the reasons I just explained. And part of the reason why we thought beginning to integrate behavioral health was important. Are there other reasons that you can think of it's been beneficial to integrate?
There's a lot of benefits that I've learned over the last 2 years, just from my own perspective. I think it having behavioral health integrated really reduces any kind of stigma that people might associate with asking for help for parenting concerns or even concerns that their child might have a mental illness. That's one, and I think that's especially true for certain cultures where it's not seen as a positive thing to ask for help, so having it right there. It also takes away any aspect of sort of the fear of the unknown. We learned that really quickly, too, when we started providing behavioral health at Alaska Center for Pediatrics. We figured that out quickly, that parents or families were more likely to follow up if I met them when they were there in the office, when they could see my face and know who I was. It was much easier for them to come back. Mm-hmm. And we also know that part of the reason we're doing this is because a lot of times in primary care, when people are referred out for mental health services, they don't go.
Right.
I think that's about,
right.
I think that's more than 50%.
Right.
Don't often
and the
go.
Reasons for that are legion. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense. But once you make some contact with somebody, and it's right now, right when that crisis is there, or when you're willing to talk about it, it increases the likelihood that you're going to have some follow-through and adherence to suggestions, not only in medical care, but I'm sure in the psychological services is one of the big issues. So it's trying to improve that adherence and plan without having to refer somebody out 2 weeks later.
Right.
Get seen, and the whole issue is much different at that particular time.
Right. And the communication is just so much easier when you're all in the same place, too.
Kimberly, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I was just calling to find out, are there any safeguards to make sure that people aren't being overly too often prescribed medication to help with these problems, seeing that the big function of a primary physician is to deal with medicines and not necessarily more healthy.
Yep. I got you. I understand your question. See what Jessica has to say.
From my perspective, I've only done behavioral health in one office. And what I know, from my experience right now is that that's something that everybody is very careful about. I know and I might be misspeaking, so you can correct me.
Sure.
If I'm wrong, but I know that the American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't recommend medication for ADHD for children that are under five. Is it five or something like that?
Preschool, like I said before, you got to be very careful.
Yep. Right. So that's one of my main focuses is really providing that behavioral intervention to kind of, to try that before we even think about medication. And that's our focus a lot of the time for things like anxiety and depression as well. If the anxiety or depression are more severe, then we might think about medication earlier, but we're really focused on preventing the need for that.
Kimberly, I'll address Jessica's point is that, and it's an extension of what I was saying earlier and how pediatrics has changed. I think primary care in general is moving more and more towards a preventative model of care. And there have been lessons learned. We definitely have overused antibiotics at times. And we have overused medications at times because we didn't know how to do anything different. But as the healthcare needs are changing, as we begin to understand health and prevention even more, and we have the time now to address those, I think everybody's changing, the patient and the provider. What I often worry about is we always rebound. Physicians rebound, patients rebound, everybody. So it's not that medications are overused. It's when do you use them appropriately and in what situation. And for example, the right answer is what is the best evidence for the treatment of this problem? And if physicians and mental health people are doing their work, we are constantly looking at the evidence for that. So let's take attention deficit disorder, which Jessica has talked about. And young kids, you got to be very careful. The best treatment for older kids, the best evidence is it's a combination of medication and behavioral techniques. I think it's been shown for most kids to be the most successful approach to that particular problem. So, yeah, strep throat, you need antibiotics. For most colds, you really don't need any antibiotics. I guess maybe I'm trying to read something into your question, but I think we're all moving in the direction of being much more appropriate in how we address kids' health needs.
I'm just saying I have two kids in middle school, and they have friends who are taking medicines for anxiety.
Right. Yeah, so, all right, let's talk. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think it's normal to be anxious in middle school because there's a lot of change.
Right, yep.
And I'm just saying, are we not moving towards...
Right. I think, I think I would answer that as anxiety is not necessarily all about change. There is anxiety that's very, very significant. And you could argue quite easily, and Jessica needs to pick this up, that anxiety is a very strongly associated with depression, which is very strongly associated with suicide in adolescence, and needs to be taken extremely seriously. However, the most people would agree that a talk therapy is the right therapy for anxiety. However, people can be so anxious that you can't proceed with the anxiety until you take some medication. So, right. Jessica, jump in here. I'm being the medical guy again, and that's my simple frame of reference on anxiety, for example.
Yeah, and when we meet kids with anxiety, we're not just taking that. What's been happening in the last month. We look at their history, when the anxiety started. There are things like adjustment disorders where, these symptoms might be coming about because of middle school or something like that, and a lot of changes. But we try to look at the whole picture and then, address the problem, from a couple of different approaches. And that might involve talk therapy as well as medication, but it just depends on each situation.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for your call, Kimberly. We are halfway through the program. We have two people holding on call. I have to take a short break. I want to remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion of the integration of behavioral and mental health in primary care offices with Jessica Adams. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is behavioral and mental health, but actually it's how are those being integrated into primary care, since those issues present themselves to primary care physicians on a regular common basis. Our guest is Jessica Adams. She's a behavioral health specialist at the Alaska Center for Pediatrics. And for full disclosure, that is also my office. And so I want you to be aware of that as you listen to today's program. If you have questions or comments, you can email us directly over the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. Or you can call us locally at 550-8433. You can also reach us through a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And also remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to help you at that particular time. Anders, you're on line one. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Thanks. A couple of things. One is I just wanted to thank you guys for Dr. Woodard and Ms. Adams, you're addressing this issue. It's a very important issue and very personal to me. I lost my brother on December 3rd, about a week ago, to suicide. And so it's on a personal note, this is a very important subject. On a professional note, I was involved with a technology startup company about 15 years ago. We started in 2001, and our primary focus was increasing screening with primary care. So we worked with using technology to do screening tools and helping primary care physicians screen in their offices for mental health disorders was our primary focus. And we worked on that for many years, and you know, we ran into several roadblocks and several challenges that we had trying to get physicians to focus on this. And then we talked with physicians that cared very deeply about it and knew that this was something that they wanted to do and should do. But then there was also the, well, then how is this, you know, how does this translate with reimbursement for care? How does this, what do we do when we find something? Is there mental health professionals that can then, you know, do we have anyone that we can refer them to? What do we do next? And we would, your earlier caller concerned about medications or over prescribing, and we'd get a lot of those kind of resistance to, you know, if we're just screening everybody for depression and find this, then they're all going to get medicated. And our argument is always, well, there's lots of good, viable treatments, and some are involved medication, some don't. But you can't do any of them if you don't know what's happening. And so we worked for a significant amount of time, and maybe 15 years ago was too early, and maybe now is the time that people are paying attention to it more. But appreciate it. And then the other thing is the stigmas. I think there's a lot of resistance for people receiving treatment because of societal stigmas of that if you can't just treat your anxiety, your depression, or whatever it is through just, you know, good diet and exercise, well, those may be helpful, that you're somehow not as good of a person or you're weaker. And I think people internalize that. And so I appreciate the discussion you guys are having and the important significance that hopefully that'll make.
Yeah, it's very very difficult to be an innovator. one of the questions we were going to address if we had time is the difficulties, and you've enumerated a couple of them already. And I think things are changing. Change is extremely slow, but there are still significant problems with this approach, despite its, I think, fairly obvious utility and appropriateness.
There's a lot of, you guys were mentioning about the comorbidity of depression, anxiety with other, we'll say, you know, other traditionally medical problems. And, if you're trying to get someone to, address their medication or their treatment with diabetes, if they have an underlying mental health issue, then it's difficult to get the proper treatment for the diabetes or the cardiac care or what have you.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's something that we were, you know, worked with a lot, is trying to get, you know, that there's you know, financial, there's cost savings to this, and you know, but also just getting to, you know, if we can increase the dialogue, and also with primary care, you know, in these settings, a lot of times the physicians have, you know, 12 to 15 minutes with their patient. It's a very short window where they can do all the things that they came in for, the, you know, the stomach ache or the sprained ankle or whatever they came in for, and also address these things that may be a little bit under the surface. So even physicians that are aware and are looking, it can be a difficult thing to do.
Right.
I think there's a role that everybody can play, you know, even those of us that aren't physicians. Mm-hmm. I think there's a role that we can all play in that, of trying to eliminate the stigmas and the negative content of people getting treatment, you know, and that it's making it okay for people to seek help and treatment when they need it.
Jessica, what's your thoughts on Andrew's comments?
No, I'm really grateful that you called in to share that, and I think that's a good message for everybody to hear. You know, last I checked, it's about 1 in 5 people in the United States, that's adults, suffer from mental illness at a time. So, and I believe it's something like, you know, I think 50% of those maybe don't receive treatment.
Right.
You know, so it's nothing, like you said, it's nothing to ever be ashamed of. And one of the ways that we talk about it at ACP is that, you know, this behavioral health is really just about getting some more tools in your toolbox, you know, for when life isn't easy, because it's not always easy.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. And I just appreciate you guys bringing up the subject, and thank you for... Yeah. The information in the show.
There are a lot of tools out there now, Anders. So you were at the beginning, and if there's one thing that I would say I have trouble with, is the how do I know which is the most valid tool, most efficient that we can use in a primary office? And there are actually companies come along now and helping us make that decision. There's so many of them. So you were in the right place, but a little early, it sounds like, and that's unfortunate.
Yep. Well, it's something, like I said, that if, you know, it's, we always kind of joked amongst ourselves, is myself and a couple other partners. One of them was Dr. Tom Foster in Oregon, as a psychiatrist, that, you know, kind of born out of his frustration trying to, you know, speaking with general practitioners and trying to do that. And he was like, you know, we need to make a tool that can just make it easy, you know, make it simple, that they can do. And you know, so that's kind of how it got started. But certainly there's a lot of, you know, confusion and misunderstanding. And there's a tremendous, I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't understand, is the amount of different things that primary care physicians, they're expected to know everything and to be an expert on everything. And you know, and we kind of assume that they, you know, will catch everything, and that, you know, they are human also.
Right. Yep.
And as much as they care and they try, they, you know, they need people to also understand. That's one thing when we're working with screeners. There's lots of different screeners that happen, and they actually, there's some studies showing that a very simple screener for depression that's actually fairly effective is the simple question of, are you depressed? That there's a lot of more complicated screeners that ask, you know, roundabout questions, but often patients know that they're struggling, and when they're ready to ask for help, they're willing to answer that question. You know, it's so yeah, the getting people to ask and to be willing to accept help and to do that. So.
Yep.
Again, thank you.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And our screen for adolescents with every well check is 2 questions.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's and depending on your answers, it depends where we go. But you know, it's not a hard screen, at least compared to something like an attention deficit disorder and so forth. So,
sure.
Yep. Thanks for your call, Anders.
Thank you. Goodbye.
So Anders brought up an interesting issue that I wanted to get into. What about the problems with integration? If I say, what are the problems that you've become exposed to with the integration in our office in a primary care office, what comes to your mind?
That it's not something that works for everybody, that it's not appropriate, you know, it's not helpful necessarily for children with more complex mental health needs. You know, they often need more support. In our office, I'm the only behavioral health provider, so I can't spend, you know, a significant amount of time, the amount of time that would be necessary to help and to promote the functioning of some children that just need more. So that's the number one problem.
I think there's, in my mind, there's even more basic issues, which this one is pretty basic, but mental health and medical systems in this country and maybe around the world have come from two different cultures. We have, unfortunately, two different billing systems. We have two different ways of recording and making diagnoses. We have two different Bibles, so to speak, of how we do that. And as a consequence, payment has been fractionated, and that mental health, behavioral health issues have gotten the short shrift in this country, and it's only beginning recently to be equitably covered in certain ways, particularly since the Accountable Care Act has come into existence. I think there's been more effort to try to make sure people have access or coverage for mental health, behavioral health issues. So the payment, as Anders had mentioned before, has been a problem and remains to be a problem. In this state, a particular reason that we integrated a mental health specialist in our practice is the difficulty in getting patients with Medicaid in to see anybody because of regulations requiring a psychiatrist to have substantial input. I'm not going to go through all the rules and regulations, but as a consequence of that, and the lack of psychiatrists, it remains very difficult to get Medicaid patients. So we are seeing them, or have been seeing them, in our office. And we can do some billing through Medicaid to help with them. And we have gotten grants to somewhat subsidize what Jessica does, is to try to beat the system. So financial reimbursement for this continues to be an issue. The integration of mental health and behavioral health into primary care has its own problems. It's just in simple things like how do you incorporate the information that we each get into the same chart. Another thing Anders brought up was that it is maybe cost-effective, that it may make sense to address these issues of behavioral and mental health from a cost perspective for all of us in this age of huge problems with the cost of healthcare. Does that make sense to you? And if it makes sense to you, why does it make sense to everybody?
You say, why doesn't it make sense to everybody?
Yep.
I'm not sure. I think sometimes the approach is to, you know, target what looks like the biggest problem. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, you know, prevention gets kind of overlooked in that way. Mm-hmm. But for me, I definitely see how it could, you know, save cost in the long run for sure. You know, if you think about, you know, right now, there's far too many children getting kicked out of their preschools and their daycares for behavioral problems. And if you think about that behavioral problem, maybe some aggressive behavior at 4, if that's not, you know, adequately addressed, then what's it going to look like at 10? You know, then there's social problems with other peers in school. A lot of times kids with behavioral problems sort of lose interest in school because it's not pleasant. The teachers, you know, are always getting onto them. The kids don't want to be friends with them. So then it becomes a school issue. And it just kind of goes from there.
They don't feel good about themselves.
No.
I mean, and so then they may try to do things to make themselves feel better about themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Like alcohol.
Exactly. I think it's about 50% of people, adults with addiction, have a co-occurring mental health diagnosis. So, right. Yeah.
But
if I was a payer, I'd say, show me, you know, show me the proof. And these are long-term things which make it very difficult to demonstrate cost savings.
Right.
We would like to think that, yeah, that works. But on the other side, I don't know if there's good long-term evidence. However, we understand more and more how the brains work, how kids are developed, what happens early in life has profound impacts the rest of their life on behavior. So it seems to have some validity in that approach to doing things earlier in life.
Absolutely.
We have another caller. Let's take her right now. Carolyn, you're on line one.
Well, thank you. And again, I'm glad, as I well know, you folks are not motivated by money. But as you point out, that is the siren song of most of our way of doing things, which, you know, I'm free enterprise and all that good stuff. However, we haven't paid before, and we're paying now. And when are we going to get smart and start looking not just at the cost of not having child care, but at the opportunity cost? What could these young people have become if we had had a parent at home, which, let me finish this out, in 1945 when Rosie the Riveter went back home because the men were back and needed the jobs, but the women were called upon to work outside the home. And in the mid-80s to the 90s, that was one of the major sources of the expansion of our economy. Well, who's going to look after the kids? And we didn't look to see how it was being done successfully in other countries, or we would have adopted any number of things that would have given children an opportunity to grow up in a healthy setting where they knew they were wanted and they were not neglected. My mother in 44, when she had me, she was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Now, what is it? We shove the women out in 2 days?
If that.
Yep.
My gosh, you know, the whole point is none of us, or very few of us, live in 6, 8, 10 kid families anymore. So we don't know anything about bonding with children. That has to be taught. And whenever we talk so much about family's the most important thing, well, then show me the money that's being put into nurturing families.
Right.
And I'm tired of seeing America warehousing humans. That's not a profit center that we should be proud of. And you mentioned, the aspect of kids getting kicked out of kindergarten. Oh my heavens! That's insanity defined. So again, thank you for everything you do, not just with this show, but with shining the light on what we're doing wrong, because just to say, well, we're not doing anything wrong, belies the questions I've had from people, and that is, well, what's caused all of this? Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. We better look back 3 generations and maybe even more mm-hmm. to see. And if we didn't pay then, we're paying now. Right. And how much is it going to cost us in 3 more generations?
Thanks for your comments.
Thank you.
I can't help but want to use an analogy to help people understand that as a pediatrician and as we understand child development, a way to think about all of this that will make sense. And I'm going to ask Jessica to bear with me because she probably has heard me say this so many times. And maybe she's the one who taught me this. For all I know, I'm always taking somebody's ideas. But we got to remember that our brain is an extremely, extremely good organ at learning. You learn how to play baseball. You learn how to play a violin. You know how to do it. What it is not good at is unlearning. You cannot tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. Or I'll unlearn how to play hopscotch. And so that's one basic principle. The other basic principle is in the first 3 years, 2 years of life, we get 80% of our adult head size. And we get our adult head size, that much growth in our head, not because we get more cells in it, called neurons in our brain, not because the neurons get bigger, but because what we see, what we hear, what we feel is causing those neurons to send out branches called dendrites that start making circuits with other neurons, and that's why our brain grows. And so what we learn early in those first 2 to 3 years
is really hard to unlearn for very physical, structured reasons. Not impossible, but very important. So there is probably no greater period of life when it is important for people to pay attention to kids than those first 2 to 3 years. And there are campaigns that are try to address that. If you put into your browser the first 1,000 days, it's another attempt to help people understand where we're learning and what we're learning about neurology. And as Jessica implied earlier, if you learn stress and anxiety and you don't get your needs met early in life and you have to act out to get those, get what you need in life, you learn those things in a very structured way. Your blood pressure may rise. Your stress response may be ingrained a little bit better and more effectively than it is in other people. And it has these lifelong consequences. So, Jessica, anything you want to add to that? Does that make sense to you?
Definitely does make sense, and it makes me think of, as kind of a silly thing to say, but one of the things I say a lot of times too is it's kind of, as an adult, you know, when you're trying your best to be a parent, you know, I have 3 kids myself, when you're trying your best to do what you think is right and maybe what people have told you is right, and maybe it's different from what you learned as a child, you know, when you get stressed, when you're not functioning your best, is usually when one or the other of your parents kind of come out of your own mouth. So it's really hard, you know, when you get to adulthood to kind of change some of these habits and things that are sort of ingrained from childhood. And that's why I really enjoy being able to focus on the preventative side.
Yeah. All right. So what mental health people, behavioral health people can do, and particularly in pediatrics and primary care, is to be working towards this preventative aspect of it is one of the things. There are a number of other things we've kind of touched on. Helping kids with ADD learn strategies that don't need medication, helping anxiety and so forth. But there are definite preventative aspects to integrating behavioral health, mental health into primary care like pediatrics and family practice and general practice. They're dealing with some of the same issues as well. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I just want to wish you happy holidays and thanks for taking the time to do the show.
Yeah, happy holidays to you too, Bill.
All right. And the other thing is, there was a really good show on the other night about prenatal nutrition, and they said that they've known for years that folic acid had a connection in the womb, but this guy was saying that choline in the second and third trimester would activate or deactivate a gene, which he could clinically attribute to schizophrenia and possibly ADHD.
Right.
That was interesting. And I just want to make one more comment. There was a guy by the name of Utah Phillips years ago, who was a hobo. He traveled the rails during the war. And he said that he traveled safely and had a lot of fun up until the 80s. And he says then the funding for the state hospitals went away, and a lot of crazy people who were probably now in jails got out and were riding the rails. He said it became dangerous.
So
it's an interesting thing, from the womb to whatever. But anyway, thank you. I'll take any comment off the air. But once again, your show is great. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, there's definitely it gets into this whole prenatal nutrition is a separate issue of what's called epigenetics. Epigenetics, that's the uninherited environmental influences on our inherited genetics. And we now know the environment, drugs, alcohol, exposures to stress, all these things affect our genes, even prenatally. Complex. We've talked about it a couple times on the program, but the last caller is exactly right. And so there's a lot of research going into looking at some of these early stresses and some of the long-term behavioral psychological issues as well as other health issues. Another thing I thought would be worth bringing up that we haven't talked about yet, except maybe just briefly, is other things that behavioral health specialists can address. I think of one of our biggest issues that we address almost daily in the office, certainly daily, is obesity. And if there's one thing I have come to the conclusion of, the medical model of approaching obesity is not working, and that certainly we need to be taking much more of a psychological, mental, behavioral health approach to that. But we have other things, you know, the parenting classes we've talked about, substance abuse, diabetes, and how we can address how we feel about ourselves with some of these chronic diseases. So there's an immense amount of behavioral mental health
aspects to primary care. So I guess what I'm trying to say again that behavioral health specialists in the office can do that we haven't even, as much as we might be interested in, been able to find the time to do yet.
Yeah, there's health coaching, too,
yep.
which is kind of
coming,
a structured way of setting goals and doing follow-up, you know, in terms of working towards even just physical health goals. So, again, weight management or diabetes or
Stress reduction.
Right.
Okay. So we're not the only practice in Anchorage that we know of that has integrated some behavioral health, and we should take the time to just mention others that we know of, not knowing that we know everybody, but what comes off the top of your head of people that are doing this?
Anchorage Neighborhood Health Group, Providence Behavioral Health, Matsu Health Foundation, South Central Foundation.
Right.
Off the top of my head. It's probably not everybody.
Yep. So that they need to be appreciated for doing this kind of activity as well, and for seeing the need. What else have we? We got a minute or so before we finish. Anything that we have left unsaid that you can think of that we ought to mention here real quickly?
Just, you know, that, you know, working in this setting for 2 years, I really can see the benefit as a parent myself, you know, and what another caller, you know, mentioned earlier just about, you know, parents working out of the home and everybody being so busy. It's just so much easier for everybody, probably not even just parents, but adults, you know, in their own health care, you know, just makes so much sense to have behavioral health care and the regular primary care to be housed in the same place. It's, you know, if I'm thinking about it for myself, it would be so much easier to address those needs in the same place than to be thinking about going outside and doing all the paperwork and kind of getting enrolled in these other places, especially for the more minor behavioral health needs.
All right. So a favorite question that's becoming important to me is to ask listeners, or my guests, I'm sorry, to tell listeners the one or two most important things you want them to remember from this program.
You know, I think the number one is just, you know, thinking about prevention. You know, prevention really starts in childhood. And I would say we didn't really talk about it a whole lot, but I would say, you know, the earlier, the better. In terms of some of these behavioral health needs. And then number two is that it was a good reminder today talking to Anders, one of the guests that called in, just that, you know, you should never be ashamed and there should be no stigma around behavioral health needs and mental health needs because it's so much more common than people realize. And sometimes, you know, there are things that are easily addressed in not a ton of visits, but it's okay to always ask for support and help. And that goes for parenting, too. You know, there's a lot out there about parenting, and sometimes we don't know what's true and what's not and what's really going to be helpful. So ask for help.
Jessica, I looked forward to this program, and it's really been helpful to me to have you here, and I appreciate you taking the time. It's been nice.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
My guest is Jessica Adams. So she has been discussing behavioral and mental health integration in primary care. If you want to continue that discussion, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our archives. Next week, Bruce Pemberton is going to be our guest, and he's talking about toxic anger and the role of shame in mental health with Prentice Pemberton, our co-host. That'll be Monday, December 19th. Dave Waldron was today's audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.